fatta popolo vai vai.
I'm Dime Roberts, Stage and Studio. Today we feature a piece on the songs and stories of a Tongan sewing circle in Portland. We'll hear about the Pacific Islander Sewing Circle, a group of women who get together to sew and sing in beautiful harmonies as they work. In fact, we're listening to one of their songs at a sewing circle right now. And in the second part of the show, we'll talk with playwright Steve Lyons about his play, The Ghosts of Tonkin. It's a play about the behind-closed-doors drama in Washington, D.C. that led to the Vietnam War. And it's about Oregon Senator Wayne Morris's battle to stop the war before it began. The show runs September 27th at Portland State University's Lincoln Hall. From Tonga to Tonkin, right here on Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts. For the last few months, I've been working on a multimedia project called Migrations, featuring immigrant and refugee artists in Portland. I heard about a Pacific Islander Sewing Circle, a program at IRCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community of Oregon, and Asian Family Center. Sewing is considered a folk art form in many cultures, especially quilting, which reflects the quilter's personal experiences and traditions. I was also told most of the women are Tongan and often sang songs they learned from Tonga. After hearing that, I definitely had to check it out. At George Middle School in North Portland, a group of women ages 30 to 80 meet weekly around long tables in a large classroom. On this day, there are close to 18 women with their kids. Most of the women are hand-stitching various quilts in colorful patterns that reach out like sun rays. One of the women, Kato Kakala Kavapalu, a widowed mother of three children, is an expert hand on the sewing machine. She serves as the instructor for the sewing circle.
Yeah, there's more about 20 quilts today, and different colors and different patterns. And I think we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 people, maybe they have two pieces.
When I asked if the women could sing, they all broke out in a Tongan song in beautiful harmonies, with Kavapalu taking the lead while still running the sewing machine. Many of the women have their children there. Used to the sound of their mother singing, they draw, do homework, or play with blocks in a corner of the classroom. But they still listen.
What was that song that you just sang?
You know, sometimes when we are in the youth, we just play around with the chicken. And that the song we're trying to get the chicken and follow the chicken, that's the song that we use to get more chicken. But anyway, I finished my dress.
It seems this is one way the kids can stay in touch with their Tonkin culture and language. When prompted, they can sing many of the songs themselves. Kavapalu told me she learned music as a young child listening to older women singing while doing their work.
And you know how to sing, because over there is a group of older women. They do some making a tapa, and they sit in one of the hall, and they sing while they're doing their work. And we just know it from the neighbors and friends there. And also in our church, we just have to start the hymn, and we follow them in our home, in families, in church, in school. My kids in here learn how to do it, and they play guitar and ukulele, and piano, and they learn. But in Tonga, you can do singing without anything, any instrument.
It's been a long time since most of the women in the sewing circle emigrated from Tonga. Kavapalu and her husband came to Oregon in 1987 to raise their three girls and give them a good education. Because the Tonkin constitutional monarchy has made education free and mandatory for all citizens, people there have a nearly 99% literacy rate. Quite often, Tongans come here with their school-aged children because they want them to go to college.
Everybody is here for economic reason, and that's part of the reason why I started the sewing class, so the family can save money by making their own clothing for their children and for themselves.
Kolini Fuzitua is an academic achievement specialist for ERCO and the Asian Family Center. He started the Sewing Circle in 2012 as a way not only to help out the families economically, but also to connect them with the school system. The group meets at different schools so the women can become comfortable with the building and the staff. He says the children who come with their moms get to hear stories about Tonga. The circle also exchanges current events within the Tongan community. Fuzitua says they've learned in America parents have to actively work with the teachers and the school to make sure their kids get a good education.
But the only thing that different between here and Tonga, the support system is different here. And the reason to starting up the sewing class, in addition to keeping our culture and helping the family economic-wise, is to have the parent feel comfortable with the building, the school building, comfortable with the staff, and then just comfortable being here. And that's why I have it in the school setting. We've had parents volunteering in school, become president or vice president of PTA. One of my parents was picked by Portland Public School as one of the volunteer of the year.
Fuzitua says education is a Tongan parent's top priority because in Tonga, it's the whole community's responsibility for kids to stay in school.
You have the school system, you have the teachers, and you have your parent, you know, watching over you, make sure that you get to school. But not only that, children do not, you know, like here in America, skip school and cutting school because they have nowhere to go. If you're seen out in public, people can tell because everybody's in their uniform. Whoever's driving by or walking by will grab you by the collar and walk you back to school, will throw you in their car, throw you in their canoe and paddle you back to school and throw you back in class.
And because Tonkans cherish education, many families have to go overseas to find employment so they can afford to send their children to college. Fuzitua's own parents immigrated to America in 1975 when he was 9 years old. After he completed his college degree, his parents moved back to Tonga to retire. Now he sends money back home to help his parents. In fact, Tonga's economy relies on financial remittances from family members who make up more than 50% of the population who are spread out in other parts of the world. The Tongan community is also spread out in the Northwest. Having the sewing circle in Portland is a way to connect the families.
Get the fire sewing. And you can for your kid. Thank you for me. Hey, honey.
Last week there was a funeral, and then the class was canceled because nobody's going to show up to class because everybody's going to the funeral. When we have a festive event, for example, a wedding or a birthday, everybody will show up, and there's no invitation needed. As long as you hear there's something going on, you show up.
While they may have this community support system, many still have low incomes and face health dangers because of American fast food and what Fuzitua calls a generally starchy Tongan diet. Many Tongans in Tonga and in America are obese, and 1 in 4 develop diabetes. And moms like Kavapalu, who works as a certified nursing assistant while caring for her elderly mother, find it too expensive to buy healthier foods for her three children.
In Tonga, you walk over there, but over here, you just get up and then get in the car and then drive. Our food here is very expensive. It's okay, but we are not feeling satisfied with the food that we used to. We have taro root, taro leaves, fish. In Tonga, they grow their own food. Over here, because of the season, we can't grow crops here. Right now, there is more Tongan family struggle with financially, mostly for more kids' expense at school, and not only that, for their home, utility bills, and some money for food. But we'll try to manage our little money that we have so we can have healthy food.
Kato Kakala Kavapalu cherishes the community kinship she gets from the sewing circle, singing with the women as they work and making beautiful quilts. She considers sewing an art form the women have learned from their elders before.
Oh, we consider it's artistic. And that's all. We have art at school, and those things, it's really very artistic and using our talent. It's a kind of part of art. I think if we still get together for like a couple of years, we'll be stay. We pass it from our generation to the next generation. The more we stay together, the more we happier. Most of us, we did not know how to do sewing. We did not know how to do quilt. But the first time we just get together and talk, and then we get together for sewing, and now we accept those everything that we learned from some other people they know better than us.
The sewing circle meets again this fall throughout the school year. If you want to be part of this Pacific Islander Community Arts Group, visit irco.org for more info. This piece is part of the Migrations Project, funded by the Regional Arts and Culture Council's Individual Artist Program. If you are or know an immigrant or refugee artist, please contact me at the Migration Arts page on facebook.com/migrationsarts. I'm Dime Roberts, Stage and Studio. If you missed that piece about the Tongan Sewing Circle, you can hear it again at stageandstudio.org. You can also see photos there of the Sewing Circle. We're moving from Tonga to the Gulf of Tonkin, the Ghosts of Tonkin, to be exact. It's a new play about Wayne Morse's heroic stance about the Vietnam War. The show runs September 27th at PSU's Lincoln Hall. And joining us via phone is playwright Steve Lyons. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning to me.
It's so nice to meet you via phone. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that gave LBJ authority to basically send American forces to Vietnam. And Wayne Morse is actually a personal hero, one of my personal heroes from my childhood. He was one of two members of Congress to try to stop that from happening, that resolution. And what made you want to write the play about Wayne Morse's heroic stance during this time and at this time in your career?
Well, I wrote The Ghosts of Tonkin in 2002, and I would have never written it if we had not invaded Iraq. So when the Iraq War began, people and weapons of mass destruction were not found, which, remember, of course, was the excuse for invading Iraq. People drew an analogy between the genesis of the Iraq War and the beginnings of the Vietnam War. News media in the U.S. Asserted that the weapons of mass destruction of the Iraq War were the moral equivalent of the Gulf of Tonkin incident of the Vietnam War. And I had no idea what they were talking about. I never heard of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But they seemed to be saying the Vietnam War happened just like the Iraq War as the result of some bogus intelligence, or I wasn't sure. It was pretty profound, though, that the Vietnam War started as a result of a mistake. So it made me curious to learn more about the origins of that war, and that curiosity eventually led to this script.
Well, what can we learn from Wayne Morris's stance then, and what did you learn that we can draw analogies from, especially from the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, but also from what is happening today?
Right. First of all, what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin? This research revealed that there were two attacks by the North Vietnamese on a U.S. destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin. And it was the second attack that inspired LBJ to introduce a resolution to use military intervention. But the second attack, which the sailors honestly thought that they were under attack, their radar and sonar were telling them that there were boats out there and that those boats were firing torpedoes at them. So they thought that they were under attack, but rigorous analysis of the circumstances, which the commander of the boat later cabled to Washington, D.C. and said, we need to do a complete reevaluation because this may simply have been the result of an overeager sonar man. That complete reevaluation was never done. And so perhaps the lesson, or one lesson, is just the casual attitude of our leaders as they make these decisions to do go to war.
Well, it's so interesting
and
that you
and of
say
course,
that.
Wayne Morris was, as you said, one of two senators to vote against it. And Wayne Morris is such a he's also a hero of mine. He's such a Cassandra figure. He's like, he had the ability to predict the future. When he voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution on the Senate floor, he said, future generations will look with dismay upon a Congress about to make such a historic mistake. And that, of course, was pretty darn accurate.
It was
But like Cassandra, he also, of course, carried the curse that no one would believe him.
Wow. On a personal note, I want to say it was very interesting you said that about the sonar man, because it brings up something in my family lore that my father was a radar specialist in the Air Force Intelligence during the Gulf of Tonkin event. And
he swore
to me that he watched the U.S. ships chase the North Vietnamese PT boats into the Gulf so they would shoot at them. And I don't know what to make of that. Have you heard any kind of stories like that in your research?
Well, okay, so there were two attacks. The first attack did in fact happen, and the reason we did not retaliate for the first attack, and the reason LBJ did not introduce like legislation to use military intervention, was that our intercepts indicated that those PT boats that did the first attack were just some rogue North Vietnamese commanders who were miffed that the Maddox, which is the name of the U.S. destroyer, that the Maddox was going into their territorial waters. So they were going to run the Yankees out of town, and that was the first attack. The second attack, it was a dark night, and it was high seas, but they never saw any attacking boats. It was all based on just these radar returns that were telling them that there were boats out there, and the sonar returns that were telling them, these guys are firing missiles at us.
Mm.
I mean, not missiles, torpedoes at us. But so that is pretty much what my research has uncovered.
So we have these major world events playing out in the Gulf of Tonkin, and you want to write a play about this. How did you structure this play? I mean, it's a huge topic in of itself. So, and you have a one-hour play here. So how did you choose what you wanted to portray here?
Yes. So, yeah, exactly. My source material takes up about 7 feet of my shelf. Plus, I listened to dozens of hours of LBJ's telephone conversations on tape, around that time. And I interviewed countless people who were somehow involved in that fateful first week of August 1964. So the telephone conversations were key to making this play authentic. And in the play, a lot of the interactions that we see on stage that take place in person actually are taking place on the phone. But as a playwright, I had to do a couple of things. One is a play or a movie can't have one-dimensional characters. You have to find the Achilles heel of the good guy. You have to find virtue in your bad guy. And finding virtue in my bad guy, which was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, provided a real challenge. As I was initially writing the play, I was so angry with him that I just wanted to crucify him. Mm. But he misled us into a war that killed 2 million people. But you just, as a playwright, you just can't do that. You've got to find a kernel of goodness or principled action. And in reflecting and in like reading in retrospect by Robert McNamara and watching the Fog of War, which is the documentary about Robert McNamara, I did find principled action in what he did, but I still don't agree with what he did, but I understand what he was trying to do. And the principled action of Robert McNamara was he was deathly afraid of Barry Goldwater, because Barry Goldwater had threatened to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. And remember, so this is August 1964. In November of 64, we were going to elect a president, either LBJ or Barry Goldwater. And I think that Robert McNamara was going to do whatever it took to be sure that Barry Goldwater was not elected president, including misleading Congress.
Well, and so you did find a way to make him a three-dimensional character then.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to as a playwright.
The other difficult thing about writing this play is that the plot revolves, or part of the plot revolves around technical information. And information is deadly on stage. A film or a play can't be about information. It has got to be about human relationships. So another challenge I had was I had to seamlessly weave some technical information involving things like some of the stuff I've already met, like the torpedo capabilities of a PT boat, or O-Plan 34A, DeSoto patrols, date timestamps, NSA filing systems. I had to get all of this stuff out in the context of human relationships. And so what I did in the play was there's a male Pentagon employee who's sort of chasing around a female Pentagon employee, and within the context of that kind of love relationship, or he loves her, she doesn't reciprocate. All this technical background information comes out in actually kind of a humorous way, and in so doing, when Robert McNamara is before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and they're having a hearing on this Gulf of Tonkin resolution, the audience knows, has enough of the background information, that they know that Robert McNamara is lying. So that was a challenge.
Well, yeah. Well, throwing in human interest in there is always a good idea, too, when you're dealing with such a large topic. You've also got some great actors, one of whom I've known for years, Gray Eubank. He's playing LBJ, which is quite a find there.
Excellent LBJ. And then he plays up in the Gulf of Tonkin hearing. It's Gray who plays all of, or not all of the other senators, but like I think six or seven of the other senators in that hearing, in that rather pivotal hearing. Yes, Gray is having a heck of a lot of fun playing LBJ. And of course, once you put LBJ on stage, your play immediately becomes a bit of a comedy as well. Cause he was
larger than life, wasn't he?
Yes, he was
in many ways.
And his way, LBJ's way of describing things, saying things was kind of funny. So LBJ gives some comic relief.
Well, now in this 1 hour play, I mean, you've also got a discussion at every performance, and you've been touring this play, and locally here, KBOO's Joanne Hardesty will be moderating the talk back, which will be this weekend when it plays on Saturday. What kind of topics do the audience bring up after watching this play?
Right. Well, we had in Bellingham, we premiered it last month, and we had over 600 people attend, which was incredible because Bellingham is one-tenth the size of Portland. So we were delighted at the level of interest. So the play was definitely enthusiastically received, and the post-play discussion was very moving. This is, we had a lot of Vietnam vets in the audience, and this is not an easy story for vets to witness. The play lays out the casual, almost flippant attitude that pervaded Congress as they voted to use military intervention in Vietnam. And, of course, it's a war that kills 58,000 Americans and nearly 2 million Vietnamese. So, of course, the play is really disturbing. If you lost a family member or you were over there and you lost comrades, and just to see the way... The profound lack of rigorous analysis as we stumbled our way into Vietnam. So in the discussion, the vets spoke up about their experiences in Vietnam and their emotions in watching this play. I think the post-play discussion was cathartic, I think, for a lot of Vietnam vets. And I, of all the different wars, Vietnam vets, I think, are the most... I think feel the most abandoned by the government and shunned by society because they gave it their all, but it was an unpopular war, and that dichotomy, I can't imagine. I can't imagine how they must feel, but and the audience appreciated hearing from these various veterans.
Well, it's important to remember them, too, and to have this, even if it's a painful forum, to be able to have them to speak out about it, too, at this time and give their point of view.
Yeah. And Joanne Hardesty, who's leading the discussion, I don't know if you know this, but she is a vet herself.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah,
okay.
She actually served in the Navy.
Wow. Well, then that would be very powerful moderation. Yeah. Then, The Ghosts of Tonkin, written by Steve Lyons, directed by Mark Kuntz. It's Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Lincoln Hall at Portland State University, PSU. The address is 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. To reserve tickets, visit pdx.edu/boxoffice/tickets. I also have that link at stageandstudio.org. There's also performance on Sunday, September 28th at 7:30 at the Wildish Theater. That's located at 360 Main Street in Springfield. So you're going from Portland to Springfield over the weekend, and you can call 541-868-0689 or wildishtheater.com if you're in Springfield at that time. And the play started in Bellingham, Washington. Now, you've gone quite a few places and more to come in the months?
So it ran two nights in Bellingham. It runs one night in Portland, one night in Eugene. And there's talk of taking it to Seattle.
Wonderful.
But that's still up in the air.
Well, let's hope so.
We actually don't know, and there's talk of taking it to Eastern College. I'm sorry, I don't know.
In Eastern Oregon or Eastern Washington?
Yeah, Eastern Oregon.
Well, Steve, we're running out of time. It's so great to talk with you. Thanks so much, and have a great weekend and a great weekend run.
Thanks to me.
Take care. Steve Lyons, Ghosts of Tonkin. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to engineer Janet Anderson. I'll have the show online later today at stageandstudio.org, as well as the podcast on iTunes. And you can like us at facebook.com/stage, the letter N, studio, or tweet me at stage, the letter N, studio. Till next time, I'm D. May Roberts. We'll hear more from the Tonkin Sewing Circle.
Sa le lao si vae, sa le lao si vae, le manue.